As the pilot of a small plane, I plan my stops at airports that cater to general aviation. I look for a combination of location, best fuel prices, services, restaurants, and maybe even a crew car. But in an emergency, I'll head for the closest appropriate airport. When the pilot of a Cessna 210 declared an emergency, ATC directed him to land at one of the busiest airports in the U.S. That airport? We'll find out on this episode of ILAFT. I learned about flying from that. Hello and welcome to episode 60 of Flying Magazine's I Learned About Flying From That podcast, brought to you by Avemco Aviation Insurance. I'm Rob Ryder. My guest today is Tom Hill. He and his family were flying from Cape Cod to North Carolina in May of 2002, when he heard a loud bang and saw something fly right over the windscreen in front of him. He didn't know what it was, but he declared an emergency, and New York Air Traffic Control vectored him to John F. Kennedy International Airport. He had quite a welcoming committee. He'll tell us all about it right after this word from our sponsor, Avemco Insurance. Since 1961, Avemco has been the only aircraft insurance company that lets you speak directly with a decision maker empowered to approve coverage based on your unique situation. Visit avemco.com/flying or call 800-338-8705 for a quote and save an instant 5% for being an I Learned About Flying From That listener. Save even more for most recurrent training, a new rating, or participating in Fast Team Wings. Just ask an Avemco Aviation Insurance Specialist how you can qualify and how much you'll save. Now, I learned about flying from that. My guest today on ILAFT is an anesthesiologist, and it took me a long time to be able to pronounce that well, but his name is a little easier. Tom Hill is his name. Tom, welcome to ILAFT.
Rob, thank you. It's a pleasure.
I am so glad that you've become a listener and that you have submitted to me the story that you have about this exam, this very tough situation, not so much in terms of the emergency to the airplane, but when it took place. And that's going to be fun to talk about because that was crucial in how this story unfolded. But before that, tell me a little about your aviation journey and how it got you to that emergency back in 2002.
Let me go back to high school. I used to play hooky. I grew up in Fairfield County, Connecticut, in Wilton. And I used to play hooky in high school and go to Danbury Municipal Airport and get one of the instructors to take me up and just fly me around. And Rob, something that we don't have to discuss, but it was a Cherokee 140. The trim tab was in the ceiling, and the man used to spin this handle in the ceiling to trim the plane. And I remember asking him about it. But anyway, that's where I got started. And I just loved flying from there. Had a friend in high school whose father was a senior captain for American. And he would talk to me about careers in flying and such. And I, at one point in my high school career, I really wanted to become a commercial pilot. My dad said, go into engineering, do something else. And so I did. But that was where I got my start in aviation. I never really flew until I was in medical school. I was a physician assistant before I was in medical school. And I was working in the evenings after classes at a local urgent care in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I was at Wake Forest University. Mm-hmm. And one of the nurses knew an instructor in town. And for some reason, we struck up a conversation about learning to fly. And she goes, I'll get you in touch with him. And I started, and my roommate and I together learned. And we began in December of 1984, 85. And 6 weeks later, I was soloed and started out on a flying career and have never stopped and just absolutely loved it.
This is kind of interesting, Tom, because so many of the guests that we have that story of wanting to be a pilot since they were a kid. But you got the dream, but you set it aside for a long time.
Yeah. I was just, you know, all through college when I was in Penn State, up at State College, University Park has a big airport. And I would go out there and just sit on the tarmac and watch planes come and go. And as a kid, my dad used to take me to Bridgeport Airport, Danbury Airport, and down to White Plains to their airport. And we would just stand up there with a radio or listen to the tower talk to the planes. It was great. My dad did fly amphibious aircraft out of Rowayton, Connecticut. But that's when he was a teenager and early adult before he got drafted by the Army.
Well, you got through medical school then. You got your license. Did you move on at the same time you were pursuing your medical career and your medical practice? Did you also go get your instrument and other ratings as well?
Once I left medical school and residency, I didn't have time. I was in Boston at Massachusetts General Hospital. There was no ability to fly up there in Boston. The nearest municipal airport, of course, was the Air Force Base. I'm blanking on it. It's west of the city. But anyway, there was no place for me to fly then. It wasn't until I got into practice, again, back in Laurinburg, North Carolina, just south of where I live now, that I retained an instructor and one of my fellow physicians, a cardiologist, had a Cherokee 6. And I said, can I use your airplane to get my instrument? And sure enough. And that instructor is now an overseas pilot for American. And he flies all over South America and Europe. Flying Airbus 330s. Wonderful guy, did a great job in training me.
And the Cherokee 6 is a great platform for instrument flight.
Oh, yeah, it is. And, you know, it's powerful. And we did most of our work at Florence, South Carolina's airport, and Myrtle Beach, which at that time was still an Air Force base. There were still A-10 Thunderbolts that were working out of Myrtle Beach.
Oh, yes, I remember that. Oh, boy, that must have been fun to watch those guys come in.
Yeah.
Yankin' and bankin'.
The Warthogs.
The A-10 remains a remarkable airplane in my mind to this day. But back to you. Did you go on with your training? Did you go to more motors?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I got a multi-rating. There's an organization out of Raleigh, North Carolina that says, you know, we'll train you in multi-engine if you want your hours and that. So I went up to that organization in Raleigh and did my multi-engine, only have about 15 or 20 hours. But my instructor that I had done my instrument with had access to a Cessna 310. And so I got about 5 or 7 hours of flying in the left seat in the 310 with him. And I thought at one point I would like to have a 310. And then we got talking about care and maintenance of dual power plants and an aircraft like a 310. But I also did my commercial rating, so a commercial ticket. So I have single-engine land, I have instrument rating, I have multi-engine, and then I have my commercial ticket. I keep myself current and enjoy all of it.
Well, let's go from 1984 when it all started up to 2002, and that was an important year for aviation because the right after 9/11 in 2001, the world changed a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And it has a profound effect on what happened to you. Tell us about your I laughed moment and the airplane that you were flying and what went down that day.
Sure. Prior to owning a 210, it was a 1974 model 210. I had owned a 1970 model 182 and loved it. Had that when I was living in Laurinburg and did a lot of my training and a lot of IFR work in that 182. But my two kids would be in the back seat wrestling and the entire airframe would be going back and forth and I'd be yelling, sterile cockpit, sterile cockpit. You guys stop moving. So I finally said, I got to have a bigger airframe. I got to be able to separate these kids because Amanda was 10, Stephen was 8. So I picked up a 210, 1974 210 from an organization in Greensboro, North Carolina. The aircraft had been a test platform for the organization. They were doing upgrades to IO-550s. And then they would mount them on this airframe, fly the engine, and then send it back to its owner. They eventually wanted to sell this airplane, and I was able to buy it. And it was a beautiful 210. No GPS, just all steam gauge, autopilot, and you know KX-155s for communication.
Dual NAVCOM, so you could do all, you had plenty of backup to shoot approaches and all of that, right?
Yes.
Did you have an ADF?
Oh, yeah. I did some NDB approaches in this. And I did, when my kids were little, I had my wife trained as a private pilot also. So that while we were flying, if I collapsed, did anything, she could land the airplane from the right side. And I specifically had her instructors landing the 182 from the right seat.
Wow.
So that she could do that. So as we talk about this I laugh moment, you'll hear what Beth was able to help me with. I had 540 hours on the engine, but But when I purchased the airplane, the prop had not been overhauled. And I asked them, what's the frequency of doing prop overhauls? And they said 600 hours. So I took it back to the organization in Greensboro, upgraded an autopilot and had them take the prop off, do the overhaul. That was in April of 2002. We then were up in Cape Cod visiting friends in the end of May and flying back.
So you're talking right around Memorial Day then.
This was Memorial Day Monday.
Wow.
After 9/11.
Okay.
We were on an IFR flight plan. I look back at my logbook and we were flying on an IFR flight plan. We were somewhere over Sheep's Head Bay and I heard this bang in the front of my airplane and saw something fly off of the airplane behind me. Obviously, I was in contact with New York Approach. I said, New York Approach, Centurion 59176, I need to declare an emergency and land. Something has just flown off of my airplane. Controller very calmly said, how many souls on board? How much fuel on board? Are you in control of the aircraft? And I had said to Beth while he was talking, honey, you watch the gauges. Make sure the EGT, the oil pressure, the oil temperature, everything, the ammeter, everything is in the green. And so Beth kept an eye on the gauges. I flew the airplane.
And she saw that they were in the green. There was no change in any of the engine indications at all.
Whatsoever.
Wow.
So we're flying along and they said, you're clear to land runway 31 left at John F. Kennedy. And I kind of went, John F. Kennedy. And then Beth said, I smell smoke.
Uh-oh.
And I did not see smoke, but immediately the emergency procedures for engine fire went through my head. Lean it, turn off the gas tanks, turn off the magnetos, and then slip the airplane to the right so if there's any fire or smoke, I can see out of my side window to land the airplane. But none of that happened. I didn't see any of that. I continued to fly it. And the airplane, we weren't very far from John F. Kennedy, and we weren't very high. So I said to the controller, you know, the airplane's flying just great. Maybe I can land somewhere else other than Kennedy. He immediately came back and said, negative, just land. So I lined up for runway 31 left, and the tower came on and said, you're cleared to land. The whole runway is yours. And just then, my 10-year-old son, who was in the very back seat with a pair of Dave Clark juveniles on, says, hey, Dad, that jet behind us just turned out. And I thought, I just took over an active runway at John F. Kennedy.
In some of the busiest airspace at one of the busiest airports in the country, where that just it covers part of Long Island and all of that area. When those other airplanes got out of the way, did the frequency go totally quiet and was just you and the controller at that point?
Would that be correct? It was just me and tower. And I think there's more than one tower freak at Kennedy, but I was just dedicated to one guy. I looked down at the runway. It's huge. I mean, it's more than 150 feet wide, and it's more than 10,000 feet long. I could have probably landed sideways on the thing. But, you know, I go through my descent and landing check, gumps, you know, gas, undercarriage, mixture props, safety. Everybody's buckled in tight. I said, the airplane could stop working at any time, Beth. Everything's in the green, Tom. I don't see any changes in the engine. Brought it down, rolled out, and there was at least four or five police cars and a couple fire engines who escorted me down the runway. Tower says, turn off on taxiway, whatever, go to the Port Authority building. And I thought, you know, there isn't an FBO. There's no small FBO with hangar bums in it here at Kennedy. There's just the Port Authority building.
Well, let me ask you this, Tom. Did you ever get a sense of when they were following you down the runway that they were responding to still in that mindset of 9/11 some 8 months before that? Did you think that they were treating you potentially like a terrorist?
Exactly. That's what I thought with all the police cars. And then the fire engines were on both sides. And my thought was, is that if they needed to stop me, they were just going to pull in front of me and just stop me on the runway. But they didn't. They just followed me all the way in, and a big engine, a big airport fire engine, pulled right up in front of me, and a big burly guy gets out, and he's got a hose in his hands. I come around to the front of the airplane, and lo and behold, the spinner is torn off. And what I notice is that the base of the spinner is torn back and ratty, and it's eating into the cowling. It's been chewing into the cowling, And I think that's what was causing that smell that Beth was smelling, was that some of the cowling was being eroded by the base of the spinner. So the fireman turns to me and he goes, "You're a pretty lucky guy," in his Brooklyn accent. And so that was that. We pulled all of our gear out of there, went inside, said hello to the nice people. I'm still shaking. You know, I've gone through, and I, you know, at one point I thought, did I close my flight plan? I thought, no, I don't have to worry about that. I'm at a major airport.
No, you don't have to do that. I have, although I will tell you, twice in the last year, I have had to pick up a VFR flight plan, and one time I failed to close it. The second time I thought I could close it with air traffic control. No. To close it with flight service. So
exactly.
I either do flight following or I do an instrument flight plan. Now, I got to tell you, I have flown over John F. Kennedy Airport in New York a dozen times when I go up there for the air show up on Jones Beach. That is one busy airport. When you got off, did the police draw guns on you or anything?
No. No one did anything like that. They came up and asked if we were okay. My kids were pretty upset. Beth was pretty upset by it. We got our stuff out. I said, look, let's go inside the FBO and figure out what we're going to do. The airplane is obviously not flyable. And the Port Authority, the person in charge of that day, because it was a holiday, it was Memorial Monday. But it's a very busy air traffic day, because I can remember afterwards there was just jet after jet after jet. And I said, we need to get to LaGuardia and get home to Charlotte, and somebody will have to take us home to Hickory, because we were living in Hickory, North Carolina at that time. And the FBI, I said to the FBO guy, can I leave my airplane here? He goes, well, there'll be a big fee to tie it down, but you're going to have to find somebody to ferry it out of here. And we did. I called my insurance company immediately, and I don't remember if it was a VEMCO, but I remember my agent back in Asheville, North Carolina, was extremely good. He goes, are you okay? I said, I'm fine. The family's fine. The aircraft flew perfectly fine. What eventually happened was that they arranged for a group out of Islip to come and bring a new prop, put it on, ferry it over to Islip, looked at everything, repaired the cowling, repaired everything. But the interesting discussion was with the flight service director. I always get it wrong. Is it the FDSO or FSDO?
FSDO, FSDO, Flight Standards District Office.
Right. And the gentleman calls me, hello, Dr. Hill. That was quite an event you had on Memorial Day over John F. Kennedy Airport. I said, yes, sir, it was. And he said, do you have any idea? Did you have this prop worked on? And I said, yes, I did. I had it overhauled just the month before. Uh-huh. Well, we've had one other report of a spinner leaving an airplane, and it was in a Cherokee 6. And what we surmised is that it was an asymmetric tightening of the screws on the spinner to the prop, and it caused it to vibrate off.
Asymmetric? Do you mean, are you saying then, because you're way ahead of me, because I was going to ask the question about what caused this, but Tom, was there a screw that was, are they saying a screw that was too loose and worked its way loose and as a result caused the vibration?
The only thing that director mentioned to me was that when you put a spinner on, and I'm not an A&P. He said that you have to tighten something at 12 o'clock, tighten something at 6, tighten something at 3, tighten something at 9, tighten something at 10, 4, and 2, and 8.
It's kind of like when you change the tire on a car and you put the lug nuts back on, you don't tighten them down adjacent, you skip one in between to make, hopefully, the torque and the tightness similar for all five of the lug nuts. Is that what this guy was saying?
That's what they surmised. And I really don't know, Rob. Only thing was that, as best I could tell in 2002, the FAA had only had one other described incident with a Cherokee 6, now, which was, again, a 300-horsepower engine.
Yeah, you told me that they changed the propeller. So even after you had a brand new, freshly overhauled propeller, they changed the propeller so you had a different prop and a different spinner when you finally took it back home?
I can't recall if they put my prop and spinner back on. There's nothing wrong with the engine, nothing wrong with the crankcase. The prop was a little nicked up, because I remember looking at that and saying, oh my God, I can't believe this didn't come through the windscreen. But it didn't.
Wow.
And it was just this blur that went right over the top of my airplane. So that spinner is sitting somewhere at the bottom of Sheepshead Bay. But that I'm pretty sure that they did put a whole new prop on, although I don't have the logbooks to be able to tell you what they did. They eventually ferried it down to Hickory, and then I got the gentleman a flight from Charlotte back to New York. And ever after that, it worked great. I guess I asked, did you put the spinner back on symmetrically tightening all the nuts? And I'm pretty sure that both the group in North Carolina were contacted by the FAA, as well as the group up in Islip worked along with the FAA on this to find out what really, really went wrong, because this was a big incident.
I'm fascinated by this, and I want to find out what you learned about this. So let's do a commercial break. And when we come back, we'll find out what you, Tom Hill, learned about flying from that. The folks at Avemco Insurance are passionate about pilot safety. That's why they sponsor the FAA's Fast Team Wings program, publish dozens of articles on safety techniques and human factors by noted CFIs, and even support I Learned About Flying from That. Visit avemco.com/flying or talk to them at 800-338-8705. Tell them you're an I Learned About Flying from That listener, and they'll even save you an additional 5% off your premium. Now, back to ILAF. We're back with Tom Hill, anesthesiologist, pilot, and one of the, well, I think the only guy I ever have met who has landed a Cessna 210 on the huge runway at John F. Kennedy International Airport. Oh, my goodness, Tom. I'm sure you've got, it's a matter of pride and surprise for you to this day.
It is. The most important thing I learned is that the air traffic controllers are there for you, and they are going to do their very best to keep you safe.
Did the guy stay really calm with you when you started?
No, absolutely. Yeah. And when he said, negative, just land, because I offered to go somewhere else, I knew that he was just saying, we don't care what happens down here. We want you on the ground right now.
That's a special thing.
Yeah. So I was extremely happy, and I told the director from FISDO that I said the air traffic controllers at New York Approach were great, and I really appreciated the tower and everything had done in Port Authority folks at JFK. It was wonderful. So I was reinforced in my beliefs that ATC is there for us, and they do a wonderful job.
They do indeed. I really like working in the system up there, flying up around that part of the country. It's busy, and they're so good at what they do. What else did you learn?
The next thing I learned was be ready to have an engine out emergency at any time and know exactly what you're going to do. Even if you're at 5,000 feet over Sheepshead Bay, and there's this massive airport just to your right, and you could lose your engine. You could have a fire immediately with your entire family on board. What are you going to do? So you must pre-flight yourself for an engine out emergency at any time, any altitude, any location.
So you learn the bold-faced items like bam, bam, bam. You can rip them right out of your head verbatim very fast.
Yeah, I have the card, but I know the first thing that you do is you just lean it, turn off the gas, turn off the tanks. And in a Cessna, of course, you have both left, right, and off. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, just turn off the mags and then prepare to ventilate the cabin. And then, as I was taught by my instructors, slip it so that you can look out your side window if there is oil, smoke, or flame that is inhibiting your view out the front.
But fortunately, none of that happened. Your wife was a very key resource for you as you dealt with the emergency. Is she flying with you much anymore?
No, not now. She doesn't have a current medical, but we don't own an aircraft right now. After the 210, we did own a Mooney for a period of time, and I had her learn how to put the gear up and down the Mooney because it was a Johnson bar. Mm-hmm. But we sold that before we moved to Hawaii for 4 months, and that was in 2013. We haven't owned an airplane since. She's been up with me in Cherokee 6s as well as Cessna aircraft. But I have not asked her to remain current or being able to do anything. She usually sits in the back and listens to an audiobook. Something narrated by Rob Ryder.
Who knows? You never can tell. Right. What else did you learn about flying from that?
That the airplane really will fly, even though you've had a major interruption to the prop. I mean, the prop itself, I must have brought it back to forward to full in position for the landing, which is what you would normally do on your GUMS check.
Sure.
But the prop was still functioning, but it was nicked up and such. And I was pretty amazed at how well the airplane flew with no vibration and how forgiving the airplane can be. So that was probably the most important thing.
All of these things are important, but I'm glad you handled the emergency in a systematic, non-panic mode, that your wife was able to help you to keep an eye on the gauges so you could concentrate on flying and communicating, and that you were under the control and in the capable hands of the controllers in New York, be they center controllers around the country or TRACON or Tower or Ground. They are all great folks.
I kind of wondered what was going on in the TRACON when I declared the emergency right after 9/11 on a holiday. And I wondered if the supervisors and the rest of the guys on the scopes down there were saying, who is this guy in this little airplane that wants to emergency land at John F. Kennedy? What's he doing up there? And I really wondered if it was a unique situation for the air traffic controllers in a city that had just been stunned by an air accident, a disaster, a terrorist attack. And that's why I thought I saw this many police cars and the fire engines down there, thinking that they would have to somehow cordon me off or keep me away from the control tower, the TRACON, the numerous number of terminals, and all the other aircraft that are there on the tarmacs. But, you know, 3-1 left is out there on the left side, on the southwest side of the airport. And after I landed, you know, everybody was very accommodating. And as the fireman said, I was one lucky guy.
And you do great impressions, too. Hey, Tom Hill, thank you for sharing that story. And thank you so much for being on I Laughed.
Wonderful. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks again to Tom Hill for sharing his story. His preparation for handling unexpected situations is a lesson that's good for all of us. As you may know, some of the I Laughed episodes come from articles written for Flying Magazine, and others have come from you, our listeners. If you're not a writer, but still have an I Laughed incident you'd like to share, let me know. Just a quick synopsis is all that's necessary. I'd love to hear your story. My email is rob@flying.media. rob@flying.media. Julie Boatman is editor-in-chief of Flying Magazine, and Lisa DeFries is the executive producer of I Laughed. Thanks for listening, and I hope that you'll subscribe and share with your friends and on social media. There's much to glean from these episodes, and part of our mission at I Laughed is to educate as well as inform and entertain. I Laughed is available wherever you get your podcasts. We drop episodes every couple of weeks so you can hear the firsthand accounts of the flying lessons that sometimes only experience can teach. For Avemco Aviation Insurance and Flying Magazine, fueling the passion for flight since 1927, I'm Rob Ryder. Catch you next time on I Learned About Flying From That.